The new book, This is the Voice, takes us on a fascinating journey that encompasses biology, neurology, music, language, anthropology, history, and culture, and argues that the voice is what makes humans the dominant species. John Colapinto is the author of the new book. John is an award-winning staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the New York Times bestseller As Nature Made Him. Again, the new book is This is the Voice. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and we welcome John Colapinto to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Joe.
A great pleasure to have you. So let us begin with the story, which is you learn that you have a serious voice injury. So bring us to that point.
Yeah, it's funny even to talk about it as serious, because I didn't think it was. I was working for Rolling Stone magazine 20 years ago. I was a staffer there. And Jan Wenner, the owner, put together a rock band from members of the staff. And I was tapped as lead singer. It had gotten out that I had been kind of an amateur singer through my college years and post-college. And I just, you know, even though I sang a fair amount for fun, I had no idea how to warm up my voice. I didn't know you had to warm up your voice properly. So I started going to these rehearsals and wailing over a very loud rock band and with no warm-up. And I blew up my voice in a way that I sort of had done in the past where I would be hoarse for a day or two. This was different. I mean, I was singing louder, harder, longer. And then when we did our gig, which was in front of 2,000 people, including a slew of celebrities, including Yoko Ono and her son, Sean, and we were singing a song written by John Lennon, or I was, with them in the front row, all of this is to say that there was a lot of stress as well. So a voice that was already compromised by what I later learned was an injured, bleeding vocal cord was also sort of compounded, this injury, by the stress that makes you push your voice way too hard in performance. So that's a long way of saying I ended up with what's called a vocal polyp.
So with that vocal polyp, how do you go from that to working to make that situation better to then writing a book on the voice and becoming focused on that?
Yeah, you know, what happened was I ignored it, to be honest. I thought, well, I've got a rattly, raspy voice right now. It'll go away. But about 2 months later, when it was still bad, a woman in my building actually confronted me in our elevator. I just said two words to her. I said, "What floor?" Because I was going to push the button. And she immediately looked kind of worried. She went, "Oh, you've got a serious voice injury." And I kind of tried to laugh it off. And she said, no, I work with Broadway singers and actors, and you've got a problem." And she said she could even see what I was doing with the muscles in my neck to compensate, to try to get more sound out of these vocal cords. But the only reason I ended up taking her seriously was she said, "You know, it could be something else." And I grew up in a medical family, and I knew that was kind of a euphemism for a bad growth or maybe even a cancer. So off I took myself to a laryngologist at Mount Sinai near me in New York, and he looked down my throat and diagnosed me with a polyp, which is this bump on the edge of a vocal cord. We have a nice, sweet, smooth voice. Our vocal cords are nice and straight edge because we actually make vocal sounds by our vocal cords chopping the airstream from our lungs into pulses. And if they meet nice and flush, you get a sweet sound. If you've got a bump, you get turbulence and rattling. So anyway, I said, "Hey, listen, well, great, you know, I've got this problem. Let's snip it off and I'll be on my way." He said, "No, you'll be checking into the hospital for several days. I'll be doing a very, very meticulous operation with you under anesthetic and a paralyzing agent, and then you won't be able to speak for 6 weeks." And he said, "When would you like to do the operation?" So I pretended that I was going to do it, and I ended up not doing it for 10 years. And then I was doing a story for The New Yorker on a still more famous vocal surgeon who saved Adele's career when she had a vocal polyp. And his name is Steven Zeitels in Boston. In doing that story, he also said, "You've got a hell of a voice problem." He looked down my throat and said, "Oh, that's a big one." And he offered to take it off when the story was finished. You know, he said, "I got to do this for you." And I was like, "Meh." Anyway, it was really in talking to him. He said to me, "Look, you know, you've developed some strategies for talking around this problem. Like I can hear that you're sort of figuring out how to smooth out the rasp a little bit. But in doing so, you're lowering your voice into a pitch that's kind of monotonic. You're not getting as much elasticity and melody what the ancient Greeks called prosody. It means toward song. We speak toward song. We put, literal melody in our voice so that people will follow us, be interested in what we say, hear the emotions of our voice, but also in order to insert a clause that we suddenly drop our voice for a little embedded clause, and so on. He said, all of that is missing. And furthermore, you are not being communicated by your voice because our voice is a fingerprint. Mm. And you've got a different voice than what you were born with. And that just set me off. I thought there's probably a book in this.
And what he said, I thought was so fascinating. You mentioned this at the beginning of the book. He tells you that this may have been brewing, the polyp, for decades before you even sang in Jan Wenner's band, and said, quote, "Wallflowers and introverts don't get this injury."
Yeah, isn't that great? I mean, it just made my ears perk up because he was 100% right. I mean, he could read personality in a voice, an injured voice like mine. He knew I was an extrovert. I'm a notorious over blabber. Your listeners have already learned that. yes, and so I was overburdened. I was like taking on a vocal load per day that was, intense. I think people that work on the radio, for instance, also need to be aware of that because they're using their voice professionally all day long. Teachers get this polyp business. So in other words, it's not just singers like Adele and opera singers and people like Julie Andrews who got a terrible polyp that ended her career.
And that too was a botched operation, right? I mean, things can go wrong here.
Correct. Because the vocal cords are so delicate and really, our voices are partly what they are because of the precise sort of elasticity of the tissue, the viscosity of the tissue of our vocal cords. And that can vary in person to person. That also means that if in doing an operation, you're removing the polyp, but you accidentally take a bit of, or even a lot of healthy tissue, i.e. not just the bump, you can really end up with a voice that is worse than before you started, which is unfortunately what happened to Julie Andrews. Yeah.
For your situation... No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it was the effort actually to repair her polyp.
Yeah.
That got her into terrible trouble.
For your situation of waiting 10 years, did the situation get worse or did it rather remain stable through that time?
It almost certainly got worse. It's interesting, both of those laryngologists, the guy that first inspected me, he actually took a photograph and showed me on the screen what it looked like. And I could actually see the bump. But when Dr. Zeitels in Boston did it 10 years later, that bump was way bigger. And I have to say, because it really what it is scar tissue. And, scar tissue can accumulate if you kind of keep re-injuring that area. And it probably wasn't finished scarring when I was first examined. So 10 years later, if you left Zeitels, who spent 30 years looking at these things, really quite aghast. He was like, okay, that's a big one. That's one of the bigger ones I've seen. So I've got a hell of a sort of a mass on my vocal cord, which also affects how it vibrates. I can't really sing at all anymore because I don't have a precision ability to shift between pitches. I've got like a heavy mass on my vocal cord.
You write in describing the book, and it's probably the best way because I found it difficult to describe what you're doing here, which is, in terms of structure, this book is a little like the vocal signal itself. It begins by examining how the voice is manifest in a single individual, a newborn baby, and then radiates outward like a sound wave in ever-expanding concentric circles, from investigating that initial assertion of raw need, feed me, to examine how we mold that cry into speech, and then we engage other voices in the form of back-and-forth conversation between two people. You talk about the rapidity of the fact that we can communicate so much faster with our voice than any other means. There are other means of communication, but it's certainly the fastest. When did you realize that structure coming together of how to tell this very complex story of the voice?
Yeah, great question. Because of course, as a writer, that's always the problem to solve. You have a mass of chaotic information, a mountain of material. And the question is, how do I, take that mountain, reduce it to like beads that I string on a string like a necklace? Because that's really what you've got to do. It's got to be one idea following another. And so that's an amazing act of structure. I have to credit my editor. The very first lunch we had, he actually used the term concentric circles, he led, because we were just sort of batting around how it might be structured. And he said, you could do it sort of in concentric circles, moving outward from the individual to conversation to a voice that addresses a larger group and so on. And that actually, I loved it, but it conflicted with the idea I had in my mind, which was kind of linear. I thought, maybe what I'll do is talk about how our voice evolved from these lungfish, these extraordinary creatures 400 million years ago, sort of through these successive refinements that turned it into mammalian noises like barks and roars of animals, and then into speech. Funnily enough, I was able to keep both ideas. The book has a linear movement through our evolution, but it's actually organized around something that my editor, Eamon Dolan, who's just brilliant, had said at lunch, which kind of combines this idea of we sort of working outward from the screaming baby. And interestingly, Eamon, it was actually Eamon's idea to move the screaming baby from later in the book to actually right after the introduction. And that was sort of a brilliant idea on his part to kind of keep that notion of the concentric circles expanding. But then we flash back and I do the evolutionary sort of linear narrative. Now, this might be sort of in the weeds for your listeners, but, you know, it really was the way to get my hands around a subject that is peculiarly diffuse and difficult, if you really think about it. And it's something that science as a whole has really not tried to address in sort of its completeness. You'll get singular sciences like, you know, phonetics. You'll get linguistics, which looks at language. Phonetics, of course, looks at the sounds of language. You get studies of accents like sociolinguistics. You get a whole constellation of these rather vast and complex specialties of voice science, but nothing that pulls it and synthesizes it into a whole, which is what I tried to do. And in doing so, I ended up with this vision and realization that it really was our voice that carried us to the top of the food chain. It's why we rule the planet.
John Colapinto is the author of the new book, This is the Voice, that is published by Simon and Schuster. Not surprisingly, with the story that you just told us, music is very much a part of the book as well. The aspect of singing and how we use our voice in that. And you write a lot about that, which is fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, our singing is so incredible. I mean, Darwin believed that our language actually comes out of song, comes out of these sort of melodic contours that we made as a primate species to express emotions, which is what all non-human animals do. Dogs growl when they're angry, and they whine when they're loving or sad or hungry. Cats, of course, have a wide range of emotion, all of it emotion-based. But if you think about it, those are pitch differences, too. So they're singing as well. So really, Darwin's idea was that which was counterintuitive, the melody came before the words. We started to be able to articulate specific words because we have a unique control of our tongue and lips and breathing that even chimps don't have. So yes, I mean, singing is so important to it. But what was interesting for me was that I have a very, I must admit, sort of scientific and Darwinian evolutionary view of our voices and why they're special. But my final chapter is on singing. And there I had to sort of throw up my hands and say, even Darwin cannot account for how singing, how just taking the voice right now, and if I suddenly start singing, something completely different starts to happen. And for myself, I always feel as if it actually does connect us in some way with this vague thing that we call a soul. We become soulful. We become more sort of emotion-based, but without just descending into barks and growls. We're not just saying, I'm angry, I'm sad. We're saying something else with singing that is literally indefinable, but that may be, curiously, the most sort of mysteriously human about us, because it's an art form, but it's communication. It's using our whole body, all the muscles through our torso. It's using resonance chambers in our head and chest. Like, we are an active vibrating instrument when we sing. I mean, also when we talk. But singing, oh, I don't know, we go into some Empyrean realm of expression that's just glorious.
You write in the book about the voice of leadership and persuasion, and I found this fascinating. You write, Lincoln's public speeches would shape the U.S. to a greater degree than anyone's before or since. Indeed, it says something about the momentousness of his influence as a speaker that the least of his accomplishments as an orator is to have invented a staple of the modern electoral campaign, the political debate. The use of the voice, being able to take what you have behind it and to craft it in a way that people, God forbid, listen to you.
It's just an art. It's a science and an art. It is what moves masses of people. In that chapter on leadership and political persuasion, I draw a lot on Cicero and the ancient writers who really talked about the voice as this instrument quite divorced in some respects from words and language, although, of course, not completely. They also wrote about rhetoric. But they did talk about how the tone of the voice, the performance, the delivery is doing things to an audience. It's holding an audience. It's convincing an audience of the trustfulness of the person that's speaking. Someone like Hillary Clinton was much, much criticized for sounding not so genuine, only because she sounded kind of schooled. Maybe some of the stuff sounded memorized. I'm not of the school that thinks she was a terrible speaker. I don't think she was so terrible. She might have had less, in fact, she did have less of the exquisite artistry, natural artistry of an Obama. But yes, I mean, you know, it's sort of that vocal quality, it's the melodies that we're singing. It's also these sort of mysterious aspects of the vibration that signal maybe a little bit of not truthfulness in some way, because we are communicating so much around the language part of our speech. I mean, You can sound hostile, you can sound sad, you can sound jealous. I mean, it's unbelievable what we're, and that is something that great orators learn to control.
Which brings us, I guess, to a chicken and egg question, which is, does charisma give you the voice, or does voice give you the charisma?
Oh, man, that is the $64,000 question. And I really, you know, a close reader of my book will see that I'm doing a fancy dance.
Right.
Because I am saying that both seem to be true. I mean, and Cicero believed this, too, you know, that the really great orators are, in a way, revealing themselves. It's not a mask. The really great ones, you're hearing who they are. And yes, so I think to a degree, brilliance of speech is inborn, or who we are is something we can't really control. But then, of course, there are all sorts of techniques that people can use to learn to sound more persuasive or more commanding. I mean, there are just things about the pitch of the voice. I mean, the science shows us a lower pitched voice is more dominating. It's a size block. It suggests a bigger body, just like a big, you know, cello is bigger than a little violin. You know, that deeper sound suggests size. And animals do that too. Little mice will actually lower their voice when they're feeling hostile. So there are techniques that can be taught about pitch and pace. You know, don't hurry, don't speak too fast, don't speak too slow, all of this stuff. But let's face it, when you're in an actual live situation of a vocal, you know, battle with someone in a debate, or when you're in a date and you're trying to impress the girl or the boy, you're really losing control over that instrument. You're flying, you know, I think you're just flying in the clouds and hoping for the best. You know, I mean, you starts to emerge.
At the end of the book, you make a very good point, which is the truth, of course, is that we all lose our voice sooner or later.
Yes, it ages. It ages. It's born in a cry in the delivery room. That's the first vocal noise. That's the first act that any human being commits on planet Earth. It stabilizes after puberty into a long run of, if you're lucky, 40, 50 years. And then it starts to quaver. And then it starts to grow a little less loud. And it starts to become a little monotonic. And that's because all of those muscles and nerves that control the movements of our speech, of our voice, because voice is a physical gesture, all of those become like an old person walking down the street with a cane or a walker. You know, stuff doesn't work as well. Cartilage stiffens up, muscles weaken, nerve impulses degrade, and all of that can be heard in the voice, and it will happen to everyone's voice sooner or later. I mean, some people are lucky, man. They keep, you know, beautiful, strong voices right into their 80s. Some people, though, at 65 start to sound a little querulous and so on. So, yes, but it's coming for us all, I'm afraid, Joe.
And my final question for you to end our time together, which is, knowing what you know now, knowing, having done the research for this book and knowing what you report to us, how would you have handled your situation differently?
You know, I guess I sort of end the book by admitting that I had planned to have the surgery, the polyp surgery, for my final chapter. It would be a wonderful way to sort of have a Lazarus like rebirth at the end of the book. And it would be like a happy ending, you know, that would force people to run out and buy it in droves. Instead, I went for the downbeat ending. What really happened was I decided not to have the surgery on the theory that our voices, because they are us, they are kind of a history of us. They're a bit of a blueprint to where we've walked. They're a map to where the roads we've traveled. Mine has a rasp and a little bit of a rattle and so on because of how I treated it. I'm somewhat reckless. As we said before, I'm not a wallflower. I'm a big, you know, blabberer. All of that is in my vocal tone, for better or worse. And, you know, it's like women getting a facelift or something, or men in this day and age. I'm sort of against that. And so I guess I'm all for sounding like me, which is really how I ended the book.
Mm.
And presumably will end my life croaking away.
But, and the other thing, and final, I said the last one was going to be the final question, but this really will be. But, and it's you, but you're also not in pain.
No, the vocal cords have no pain receptors. But it does take more work for me to push air past that bump. And so I will get more tired than a normal, a non-disabled speaker.
Mm.
It actually will tucker me out because I am using all those muscles through my torso more strenuously, no question.
Well, the book is fascinating and such an interesting story. This is The Voice is the title of the book. It is published by Simon & Schuster. John Colapinto, I thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much. It was really fun.
Thank you.
Again.
Be well. Again, the name of the book is This is the Voice by John Colapinto. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.